Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the class on pitfalls. You know, when I was growing up in the Church of Whiteville, and I think they've remodeled it since then, so it's taken it out. But the entrance had stairs going up into the auditorium, and then on each side there were stairs going down into the basement. And there was, when you walked down into the basement, there was just a low ceiling there. I'm not sure, it wasn't built right, obviously, but it was a low ceiling there. And as we walked down the stairs, you had to watch it because this thing was just right, depending how high you are, was right above eye level. And so there was several times when we had visitors that came, visiting men especially, and just, I mean, really whacked their head on that low beam going down the steps. Obviously, those of us that lived there, we never hit that because we knew it was there. And even as little boys, I remember walking down the steps, and it was probably way up here, you know, for me as a little boy, but, you know, we would duck underneath it going down the steps anyway, because that's what everyone else was doing. But, you know, the dangerous thing about a pitfall is you can't see it most of the time. You know, we have a man walking through a room here, and there's a ceiling fan or something, or a rock hanging from the ceiling. And there's a pit over here. And which is he more likely to hit or trip up on? It's probably going to be this one because this one is where he can easily see it. And that's the purpose of this class, is to simply point out some areas that I tripped on as a teacher so that you can see them and beware. You know, if you think about it, how many of y'all saw that broom there and still tripped over it? You did. Okay. Probably most of you that tripped over it, you tripped over it because you didn't see it. And I'm very thankful that some of you did. Thank you for helping bring meaning to this object lesson. But if you know about it, you're not likely to hit it. And the takeaway is awareness of the common pitfalls is the first step to staying out of them. It doesn't mean that you won't, just because you know about it, you won't hit any of these pitfalls, but as you're teaching school this year, you're probably going to think back and say, oh, yes, I remember him talking about this, and maybe it's after it happened already, you messed up. That's okay. It happens sometimes, but again, my goal was to simply make you aware of these pitfalls so that you can see them coming in time to swerve and miss them. In Costa Rica, we were driving down the road there, and roads are better now than they used to be, but I hate to know what they used to be because they are really, really bad. There was one time we were driving, trying to take a shortcut across country, and it ended up being a two-hour shortcut because it was so many potholes in the road. It was almost impossible to drive fast, and even if with driving slow, you still ended up hitting. You couldn't dodge all of them. So sometimes that's the way it is in real life, too. There is a lot of pitfalls. Maybe you can't dodge all of them, but sometimes it's better just focus on the road and just keep going, too. One thing I would caution you to be very careful is don't be in a hurry. It's oftentimes when we're in a hurry that we make mistakes. So take it slow. Think before you do things. We don't need to repeat all the mistakes of others. The only thing that we actually can learn from history is that we don't learn from history. It doesn't have to be that way. Hopefully you can learn from some of the mistakes that I have made. A lot of these concepts and points come from the Handbook for Creative Teaching. So if you've got this book, if you don't have it, I would highly recommend getting it. There's a chapter in here about pitfalls and just lots of good stuff. A lot of these thoughts come from in there. But anyway, there's four areas we want to look at in pitfalls. The one is, actually five areas. The one is faulty self-concept. The second one is ignorance of technique, simply not knowing the proper procedure. The third thing is poor planning. Fourthly, ineffective discipline. And then lastly, the moral pitfall. So hopefully we can spend some time with this, and hopefully at the end we'll have some time to talk about some of the advantages of first-year teachers. I want to end on a positive note, and there's lots of advantages of being a first-year teacher. I don't want you to think that this is going to be a really rough road that you're going to have to take. So thinking of faulty self-concept, my favorite verse in the Bible says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became, I'll change the word here, a teacher. He became a teacher. And that's what we have to do. We have to humble ourselves sometimes and become a teacher. Because when a teacher makes a mistake, I mean, so far you probably made mistakes and maybe nobody found out about them. But when you're a teacher, everyone finds out about them. It's like living in a glass house. So you need to take on the mind of Christ Jesus and look, view yourself as a servant. You're a servant. You're not. It's not about making a great name for yourself. It's about educating these children and being an example to them. Remember, you will influence more by your character and your commitment than by what you tell them. So many of these, most of these problems just simply stem back to pride in our hearts. How many of you this morning are proud? Okay. How many of you are humble? You know, if you're really humble, well, then you'll admit that you're proud, right? No, it's kind of confusing sometimes. There's not, and don't feel bad if you didn't raise your hand one of those times. It's hard to know if you're really humble. I mean, you're not supposed to be proud, right? But yet we still all, it's something we deal with all the time. So first of all, in that faulty self-concept, a pitfall that we often, I'd say every teacher probably faces this, is wanting too much to be liked, or wanting to be liked too much. In other words, you allow your desire to be liked to cost you from doing the right thing. It's okay to want to be liked. That's normal, but not at the expense of doing the right thing. Can you really be their friend? And I addressed this yesterday in the relationships class. It's important to be friendly and be loving and caring and sensitive toward them. But you can't be their best friend and be their teacher. Maybe buddy would be a more fitting term. You can't be their buddy. Because friends, they do favors for friends. We went over this. They might ask you, can we have extra recess? Can we play for story? Can we go outside after we finish our work? And there's times when that's great. But, if you have that friend-buddy relationship, it's going to be hard for you to say no sometimes when you should say no. And when you do say no, then they get upset at you because, well, they thought you were their friend. Friends don't give grades to each other. They don't admonish each other. They don't tell their friends what to do. They don't make you work hard and then grade your effort. They don't discipline you. That's the teacher's job. So be the teacher. Be an example for them. And don't join in the debate about which kind of truck is the best, because then there's no one to end the argument. And that's one thing that I struggle with. There's often times when I was teaching, especially lunchtime, and the discussion would come up and it was maybe about something. And I wanted to kind of join in and put in my 5 cents worth, because I had an opinion about the matter. But, and I'm not saying it's never okay to do that. Be careful about doing that. Don't bring yourself down on their level in a argument or something that's maybe best left to children. Again, we fool ourselves into thinking that if we let the students do what they want, then they will like us. And that is not true. Often what they say they want and what they really want is a different thing. You know, they might say that they want to be allowed to talk in class, or just, why do we have a rule, no whispering? Let's just, anyone can talk anytime they want to during class. They might think they want that, but imagine how that would be if everyone would just be talking all the time during class. And the ones, I imagine everyone would take home a large stack of homework that day because they wouldn't get their work done. So you as a teacher know that they probably will get their work done better if they don't talk in class. And so we just do that, and that's really what they want, is to have an orderly classroom. The second thing is getting discouraged. Proverbs 13 verse 12 says, "Hope deferred maketh the heart sick, but when desire cometh, it is a tree of life." And this is a great advantage of being a first-year teacher. You're coming in there with high hopes and high expectations. Remember about expectations yesterday. That's great. You need that. And that's awesome that you have high hopes and high expectations. But don't become discouraged if it doesn't all work out the first year like you thought it was going to, because probably things are going to go, some things aren't going to work out like you thought the first year, and they will keep getting better the second year and the third year and fourth year. So it's not like these romance novels where everything always works out perfectly and the handsome young man always gets married to the beautiful young lady, and that's not real life. It's dangerous to think like that. Jonathan Erb says, if all your expectations are met this year, then you probably weren't expecting enough. So it's good if your expectations aren't all met. That's great. We aim high, shoot for the moon, aim for the stars, and we hit the moon, wherever that saying goes. Aim for the moon, because if you miss, then you land among the stars. Don't try to be someone else. Don't try to copy me as a teacher. Not all of us can teach like Jonah Avina. Just be yourself. We each have our strengths and weaknesses. And Peter, when he was talking to the lame man, and this may be taking it out of context, I don't know, but he said, silver and gold have I none, but such as I have, give I thee. We give what we have. Such as I have, give I thee. Now, Peter, he must have been a teacher, because he said, silver and gold have I none. Give what you have. There was an experienced teacher that gave me some advice during my first year of teaching, and he told me, he said, you know, when people ask you how's it going, maybe just wait to answer that until you've taught at least 6 months or so. You could just tell them, you know, just wait. It's too soon to tell, because, you know, maybe the first couple weeks it might be pretty rough, and it's just a huge adjustment in all the different things you're facing. So don't allow those first couple weeks to shape your attitude about teaching or how things are going. Don't judge yourself for the first few weeks. The third thing there is letting little things affect your emotions. Letting little things affect your emotions. And this is probably more of a lady problem, I think. Ladies are very sensitive to little things, and that's a strong point in some ways, and yet in other ways it's a weak point. My wife was teaching. She taught 4 years, actually. She's a really good teacher. And no, I did not take her out of the classroom. She said no before I asked her, so that's my excuse. But she is an excellent teacher, and I would love to see her in the classroom again sometime if that's possible. Maybe both of us can teach again once we're old and children are all out of our house. But anyway, she was teaching, and one day a student came in after recess with his pockets full of acorns. And she was like, okay, you know, maybe she was thinking, what should I do? What do you do if a student comes in with their pockets full of acorns? Well, I'm pretty sure he wasn't planning to use them to add and subtract and help with his math work. So she said, go outside and get rid of the acorns. And so, okay, very obediently went outside, and she kept on teaching, and she waited, and he's not coming in yet, and waited more, and he's not coming in, and what's going on? What is he doing? And so she goes out to the front door and looks out the window, and here he's down on the ground like this, and he's, you know, trying to wiggle around, and she's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, he's trying to get the acorns out of his pockets, you know, hoping they would just fall out. And, you know, right at first she's like, okay, he's being rebellious. Here I told him he's just being disobedient, and she could have probably just, you know, just given him a spanking right then because he was not obeying. But in reality, he was just trying to be funny. He was just that type, you know. He was being obedient. You know, he was trying to get them out, but no, he was just trying to be funny. She could have taken that as a personal insult. And in fact, there was another example too. This is not my wife that was teaching, but another girl that was teaching. She, every time this boy would, maybe, you know, go up to the scoring station to check or going to get a drink or something, and if she was standing there, he would kind of just purposely, really, you know, detour wherever she was standing so as to not walk right beside her. And that, you need to be careful with that. Like, the teacher, I think she kind of took this as a personal insult that he's just really doesn't like her because he's acting like she's a piece of mud or something. But it was more the thing, I think he was just trying to be funny. So in a case like that, probably don't overreact to it. But maybe just tell them that it is a distraction when you're doing this. Don't walk way around. So there's some things like that you can. Don't take it too personal, ladies. If some of the students do something, because guys, someone does something like that, we don't even notice. I don't remember that even happened. But ladies notice things like that. Another thing you might find out is if you get a substitute teacher. The next day you come back and you say, how did it go yesterday? Did y'all have fun? Oh, yes, it was so much fun. It's awesome. You know, when are you going to leave again? they will always love the substitute teacher more than but they would not want that every day. Because, substitute teacher gives them candy and extra recess and stuff. But if you'd had that every day, they would soon get tired of that. So they will always like the substitute. I say always. Usually they like the substitute more than you. That doesn't mean you're not doing a good job. It doesn't mean they don't like you. Fourth thing there is feeling too responsible for your students. You've heard some of this already, but yes, you are responsible to cause the student to learn. Yes, but it's not your job to carry the student on your back. I think we heard earlier, these fat Americans, they pull up to the top of the mountain. It's not your job to pull your students to the top of the mountain. Yes, you go with them, maybe hold their hand and help them, but you're not responsible to carry them. And it is very depressing to a teacher to see failing grades. And I had this very real to me because when my first 4 years, I taught in a very good school, and the students were, I would say, above average probably. And then I moved to a different community where most of the students spoke Spanish as their first language, and English was a second language. And I remember looking at my report cards and the grade averages. I like numbers, and so I was looking at the grade averages. And in Dixon, where I had taught, my grade average is probably 94% of all my students. And when I went to Texas, suddenly it was 88%. And I was just like, I thought, well, wow, 94%. I'm really doing a good job teaching here. But I realized, okay, it wasn't so much my teaching as just the students' abilities there versus here. And it did make me feel like a failure, but I realized, and this is what Verlin said the other day, if we give God the credit when the students do well, get good grades, we can also give him the responsibility when they don't get good grades. Give it over to him as well. It's not always something that you're doing. And yes, you must do something about it, but don't allow those grades to make you feel like a failure so that you want to give up. Teaching is about a lot more than good grades. It's a lot more than good grades. We're developing character in these students. We're teaching them good sportsmanship. We're teaching them much more than just math, reading, writing, arithmetic. Warren Buffett said, games are not won by watching the scoreboard. Don't allow the grades to be your measure of how good you are as a teacher. The next thing there is being too perfectionistic. How many of you filled every blank on the handout so far? Okay. Usually teachers are very thorough and very complete, and that's a good thing, but it can be a pitfall because sometimes maybe we spend too much time checking over their work or agonizing over, should we count this a half wrong or a whole wrong or 3 points, and we just really agonize over things in grading or scoring, but is one percentage point going to make that big of a difference in their final grade? Probably not. And we end up not having enough time to do the important things, like studying for the next lesson. And I'm not saying we should be careless, not at all. But the problem with wanting things to be perfect is that we sometimes become discouraged then when they're not. Do your sustainable best. You will get wore out if you are always running your fastest as a teacher. You can maybe run 10 miles an hour, but how long can you keep that up? Try to do your sustainable best. There's not many teachers that teach 14 hours a day for the whole school year. Maybe sometimes you have to put in 14 hours, but don't try to do that every day. You will get wore out. Another thing, it can be overwhelming, especially for a new teacher, to think of teaching all the subjects. And you won't be able to teach every subject perfectly the first year. So my advice to you would be to instead focus on one subject, maybe one subject that you like, you know, like math. Focus on that subject and really try to teach that well. Use object lessons like Jonah says, but you don't have to do that in all of your classes the first year. Focus on one, and then the next year you can focus on English, and the next year focus on science, and by the time you've taught 6 years, you'll be an excellent teacher in all the subjects. The next thing is resisting advice or not asking for help. And I like to read a story out of the Seven Laws of the Learner, I think, that really illustrates this thing of resisting advice. So I'll read the story, and I want you to listen carefully and name the three main characters and the main attribute of each one. "These particular trout are very difficult to catch," he said. "They suck in your fly, sense the hook, and immediately spit it out." How many of you enjoy fly fishing? Okay, not many. I've never went. I really want to go sometime. "You have to set the hook in that split second or he's gone. Do you think you can do that?" "Of course," I replied. "After all, hadn't I caught all kinds of fish in lakes, ponds, and the ocean? Trout fishing in the Colorado Mountains would be a snap." The guide continued his instructions. "If you cast over there and let your fly float downstream about 20 or 30 feet, you'll probably get a few bites." I did as he said, but nothing happened. Within seconds, he said, "You missed one." And a moment later, "There, you missed another one." "What on earth are you talking about? I hadn't felt or seen anything." "You don't believe a couple trout actually bit your hook, do you?" I guess he couldn't miss my look of skepticism. "Let me have your pole, and I'll show you what I mean." On the next cast, he caught a big old trout right where my fly had been. I couldn't believe my eyes. Over and over again, our trusty guide worked with us. He would encourage us by saying, "It's in the feel of the pole, and the fly is moving in the water. You've got to learn to tempt the trout." Nonetheless, hours went by without my catching a fish, and I was beginning to lose hope. Then, all of a sudden, I began to catch those trout right where we had fished earlier. I could now feel the river. Everything he said began to click. What a thrill! Later that afternoon, a young teenager carrying a large red and yellow tackle box climbed down the bank where we were fishing. We smiled encouragingly. But then he took out some large lures used to catch bass and even saltwater fish, but certainly not trout. Our guide worked his way up to the young kid and began to instruct him that those lures didn't appeal to trout, but a certain kind of fly did. That young man told the guide to get lost. He had fished with his favorite lures, and he'd catch the fish just like he did back home. Soon our guide led us around the bend to a different patch of water that moved much more swiftly. He began to search through his fishing vest for a particular fly. He smiled when he found a couple of them. "These flies are the only ones I know that will catch the trout in this section of the river. I made them last night just for this spot. They're heavy enough to sink into that strong current, and they'll tempt those trout every time." He was right. We changed flies and immediately started catching larger trout. After a while, we returned to where the young man was fishing. He hadn't caught any fish yet and was obviously frustrated. "Stupid fish," he exclaimed. "They just aren't biting. I hate fishing." Our guide was a master fisherman. As the afternoon passed and we paid close attention to his instruction and his example, we slowly became more and more effective trout fishermen. Just as he'd said, it's all in the right lure on the end of your string and the right action on the pole. The fish are there. Fish are always there and can always be caught if you know how. Stop there. So, one of the main characters.
The guide.
Another one.
The teenager.
And
The author.
That's right. So we have three people. Now, think about each one. What would be one word to describe the guide?
Knowledgeable.
Good. Any others?
Teacher.
Experienced.
Okay. What about the author?
Teachable.
Humble.
Okay. And what about the teenager?
Stubborn,
impatient, arrogant. Very good. And we say, looking at that, you know, that wasn't very smart. We would never act like that, right? But yet sometimes, at least me, when I was first teaching, I really thought I could do this. I thought I knew what I was doing, and I realized that there's more people that knew. In fact, here's another story. When I was in one of the first years I was teaching, there was a boy. He was in third grade or second grade. Really small boy, thin, just a very petite type of boy. And his parents had the rule that he was supposed to eat all of his lunch at lunchtime. And we as teachers had talked about this, and we're like, yeah. We wish parents wouldn't make that type of rule for the teacher to enforce at school. But anyway, what were we supposed to do about it? So was supposed to, and this boy was, whether he just wasn't able to eat all of his lunch, or maybe he ate slowly and couldn't get it all down, but he was, we were finding food hidden in places around the schoolroom, like in the bathroom, or we'd find this food hidden there, and we're pretty sure it was him. He was in my co-teacher's class, and so my co-teacher came and he's like, what do I do? You know, can you talk to him? So I took him aside to the office there and just talked to him and tried to, just asked him. I was very inexperienced at the time. And asked him, no, it wasn't him. He ate all his food, and I was just pretty sure he was lying, but I didn't have any proof that it was him, and I was ready to give him a spanking for lying, but thankfully I called the school board chairman at the time and just asked him about it, and he gave me some extremely good advice that I remember for a long time. Well, I still remember it. He told me, he said, if he is lying, just wait. If he's lying, it's going to happen again. Don't spank him unless you know. And sure enough, it did happen again later, and I didn't have to take care of it. I think someone else came and took care of it, or he took care of it at home. But, that was a good lesson for me. This school board member had never taught school before, but he knew a lot more than I did about children. I was obviously just single and ignorant then, and thankfully I received good advice. So Proverbs 1:5 says, a wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. Listen to advice, even if it's from people, the school board, or someone that doesn't have any teaching experience. They do have experience in life, and they can give you good advice. All right, the second, we're past the faulty self-concept, now moving on to ignorance of technique. And I think I asked y'all if you like bananas or not, and... does anyone want to take a bite out of this banana? Just without doing anything to it. Well, no, it would taste horrible. We have to peel the peeling off, and then it'll be ready to take a bite. But as teachers, sometimes we just shove a banana into our students' mouths, and we expect them to like it. We shove facts and information and give it to them without really preparing it first. And therefore, the students spit it out because it doesn't taste good. A little bit of preparation can make a world of difference in a lesson's appeal. So, first one there is expecting books and gadgets to do the teaching for you. Now, there might be some of you who have strong opinions about Rod and Staff or Christian Light or Rebecca. You remember what you did in school, and that was what worked the best. So that's what you want to use when you're teaching. Don't blame the books on a lack of learning. It doesn't really matter if you use Rod and Staff or Christian Light or Rebecca or whatever it might be. The books can all be fine. It's up to you as a teacher to make them work. How much time do you spend or waste on your phones? That can be a huge pitfall as well. It's not so much, again, not so much the books. They will not do the teaching for you. You have to be the teacher and to explain it. You can do that whether it's Rod and Staff or Christian Light. Second thing there is not knowing the sequence of class preparation. So don't assign the lesson and then you check the work. And then the next day you look over their work and see, oh, wow, they really didn't get this. And so then we teach the lesson the next day for the one that we assigned yesterday. Make sure you teach the lesson first and then have them do the lesson. Or at least have them read over the lesson before you come to class. That can be a huge help as well. If they come to the class table and they have no idea what the lesson is about, well, then you're going to waste about 5 to 10 minutes just introducing the lesson to them. It's great if they can read the lesson ahead of time. And even sometimes, maybe it's an easy lesson and they already get it. You can just ask them, hey, did the lesson make sense to you? Especially if it was an easy lesson. Hey, that's good. You can go back to your desk and do it. Now, be careful with that, because sometimes they will say they know they understood it and they didn't understand it. So maybe you have to just put them on the board and have them do a few problems to show you that they know how. But always begin with some review. The third thing there is giving too much or too little work. This is a really tough one to know. How do you know if a student has too much work or too little work? You know, if you give them too much work, and they're taking home homework every day, the parents, you might be getting a call from some disturbed parents, because parents don't usually like when they bring homework home all the time. And especially like at the beginning of the school is a great time to gauge how much they can do, because they come in there with lots of enthusiasm, and the amount of work they get done at the beginning of the year is a good indicator of how much they are able to do, because then they're excited about it. If it starts falling off, then you can push back. When we often make homemade ice cream at home, and we have this homemade ice cream maker, it's electric, and you know how you put the liquid in there at the beginning, and when the ice cream maker is going, it's starts off like that, and then how do you know when the ice cream is done? You listen for that sound. The sound starts to change. And when you hear it really start to row, then you know it's done. You're at the right place. So when you hear your students start to row, then you know you're about at the right place. You can let off now, because you don't want to burn their motors up. The fourth thing is assigning without motivating. One question that probably every teacher hears, this is something you probably will hear sometime, is why do I have to learn this stuff? Or when will I ever use this? So be ready with an answer for that. Now, it can really intimidate a brand new teacher. So if you don't have an answer for that, and sometimes you won't, depending how it's used, just be careful about answering it right away. It's better to say, I'll get back with you on that. And then you can go home and figure it out. But as much as possible, when you're teaching the class, try to give them real life examples of how they're going to use this. If you're doing teaching them cups and pints, and you could say, if we want to serve iced coffee to everyone here in this room, you know, 30 people, and each person drinks a pint, how many gallons of iced coffee will we need? And help them understand how they're going to use this in real life. That's where it helps to know your students, know what they do for work or what their dad does for work, and involve them. Make this real life as much as possible. You know, maybe they have a horse, and you could ask them, how many acres does your horse need to be able to graze, to get enough grass? And you could think, you know, make them figure out how many feet of fence do they need to cover 2 acres? How much paint would it take to repaint the wall? And we're not going to paint over the window, so, you know, figure out stuff that's real life. The next thing there is thinking for the students. When I was in school, we were eating lunch one time, and I had an orange, and I gave it to the teacher to peel for me. And I was still eating lunch. We were talking, and before we knew it, the lunchtime was over, and I said, where's my orange? And he looked, and all it was peels there at his lunchbox. And he had eaten the orange for me, and he felt really bad about it. And that might happen to you sometimes too. But when you're thinking for the students, yes, we do have to peel the banana, the orange sometimes, but if we go ahead and eat it as well, then the student is not going to learn anything. So don't, you know, prepare the problem a little bit, make it attractive, but let the student figure it out. Allow them to taste the success of, oh yeah, that's how it works. Rather than you just, you know, like, especially story problems, make sure you let them read the story problem and let them, it's okay for there to be a moment of silence while the gears are turning in their brain. That's okay for a little bit of silence because they're thinking and they're trying to figure it out. Maybe ask them questions, but let them experience the success of figuring it out. And if once they taste that success, then it just makes a huge difference in helping them wanting to keep on figuring out the next problem. The one who is working is the one who is learning. Let them do the science experiment. Let them make mistakes and then try to fix the mistake or what did they do wrong. The next area is poor planning. And we went over this the first class with preparation. But I just want to go over a few things again in poor planning. Especially, the first one is neglecting important things to do the urgent things. What's the difference between something that's important and something that's urgent? So let me give you an example. You're on the way to the airport. And halfway to the airport, you look at your gas gauge and realize that you're almost out of fuel. But your flight leaves in an hour. And you know you've got to be there whatever amount of time ahead of time. So which is more important, to stop and fill up with gas or to get to the airport? Well, in this case, it's more important to fill up with gas because if you don't, you're going to be stuck by the side of the road and you for sure won't make it to the airport in time. But it can feel sometimes like, well, we've got to get to the airport. We're going to miss our flight. And know what is important. School duties can seem very urgent sometimes, especially if you have PTA the next night and we're trying to get ready for PTA. But it's very important for you to go to prayer meeting. Very important for you to have your personal devotions. You have to fill up that tank or you won't make it to PTA in a figurative sense. So don't neglect the important things to do the urgent things. Sometimes you might just have to not check the lessons. And especially if you don't give grades, you know, you can probably do that. Say, well, just maybe even tell your students, look, we didn't check over your lessons today. We're just going to skip it and go next. That way they know what's going on. They know that you just didn't. It's not that you forgot, but there was something more important to do. The next thing there is failing to allow for the unexpected. Make sure you take time to try the experiment yourself first. This is something that I learned. We were reading through the Chronicles of Narnia, and that might bring up a whole other story there. Make sure you talk with your school board before you read books, because sometimes there's parents that have a problem with that. That's okay. But anyway, we're reading through the first books, and if you've read the books, then you probably know what Turkish Delight is. And we just thought, oh, that'd be so fun to make Turkish Delight. And so the recipe's right, I think it's there in the book, perhaps somewhere. And so we got the recipe we found it somewhere, got it. And okay, we planned today, we're gonna make Turkish Delight. I tried to set aside enough time. We set aside an hour and a half maybe to make this Turkish Delight. And the students brought ingredients and we were all excited about it. And then when we started making it, it's basically just, you know, water and you pour in a bunch of sugar, more sugar and more sugar. And then you cook it and stir it and cook it and stir it. And it takes a long time, a lot longer than I thought. You're supposed to, once it gets to a certain texture, then you take it off and let it cool. But you can't heat it too fast. And anyway, I didn't try it first, obviously. And it was taking a long time. And I was trying to rush this thing and hurry. We got to hurry, get it done. And by the time it was done, we put it in pans and put it in the fridge to cool. And at the end of the day, we looked at it and it was very undelightful. Because it was still runny and, yeah, no one dared to take any taste. I think I tasted a little bit, but no one else wanted to try to taste it. Anyway, just try it yourself first so that make sure it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. Maybe that can be a learning experience too if it doesn't work. But sometimes we forget. We don't allow for the unexpected. Another time I was teaching and suddenly a storm came up and it was hailing. And, I mean, big hail hitting the roof and everything and, you know, we couldn't concentrate on our work anyway. We just went outside and we watched the hail fall and played for, and we just skipped a lesson that day. Just be flexible and don't allow something like that to mess up your schedule. The next thing there is not planning in enough detail. So sometimes we can fail to do that. And that's especially in math. Do some of the problems yourself first. It's easy to look at a problem and think, oh yes, I know how to do that. But when we're in class and we're trying to explain it, then we kind of get to a step where we're confused. And if we're confused, the students are going to be confused as well. So make sure that you cover the problems and do them yourself first. And we're running out of time here. Worrying about having enough to say during class. For me, that's not a problem, but for some of you, that might be a problem. It's okay if you get finished early. You don't have to talk for 15 minutes. If you get finished early, that's great. Fourth thing there is ineffective discipline. And I'm just going to maybe just pick through a few of these. Don't be afraid to discipline for fear the students will not like you. They want you to take charge. We went over that already. The second thing is adding rules or procedures after the problems arise. And this is one that is it's an easy pitfall to get into. And if you raise dogs, any of you raise dogs for sale? Okay. And sometimes puppies have long tails and people don't like long tails, so we have to cut the tail off. So when you do that, how do you do it? We cut off 1 inch one day and then let that heal up, and then we cut off another inch and then let that heal up and cut off another inch? No, the poor puppy. We just cut the whole tail off. But as teachers, sometimes we do that. We have a problem here, and so we make a rule. You know, no throwing spitballs in the classroom. Cut part of the tail off. And then the next day someone's throwing an eraser. No throwing erasers. And we cut another piece of the tail off. And as things come up, we keep making a rule and a procedure here. And just have your procedures ready at the beginning of the year and have them simple enough to where that, hey, no distractions. And it just covers all of that. We don't have to just keep chopping the tail off a little bit at a time. Over-lecturing instead of disciplining. You know, they usually know what they did wrong. We do need to warn them or make sure they know what the procedures and rules are. But be careful about, especially on the ball field, someone's being a poor sport and emotions are high and one team is losing, that team is beating really heavily, you know, and someone's being a bad sport. Now, that might not be the time just to give them a long lecture about that. Maybe wait until they cool off a bit. If a student is disrespectful, deal with it right away. Or poor sport. Postponing the discipline only causes the students to lose respect for you. Like a disease, it will spread to more and more students and the problem will become bigger. Brian Tracy says, when you must eat a frog, get it done right away. This stuff, like frogs, does not get prettier or more pleasant by either ignoring it or anticipating it. And he says, if there's two frogs that you have to eat, eat the uglier one first. The next thing is trusting the students too much. I know they look like little angels, but they are 100% human. Sometimes we have to watch and pray, like the Bible says. The next thing is not communicating with the parents or the school board. And this is something, my first child, Alec, went to first grade last year, and I think I'm having to totally rethink my perspective. I taught school for 8 years, and now I'm beginning as a parent. And suddenly I'm realizing I want the teacher to tell me if something happens in first grade and Alec does something. I want to know. Like, even if it's a little thing, that's okay. Just, I want to know about it. Even, you don't have to, it's not like I'm expecting you're expecting me to spank him or something like that. I just want to know what's going on. So communicate with them. You're both on the same side working to get to teach this child good habits and responsibility, all those things. We're both on the same side. So talk to them. Talk to the school board. Talk to the parents. If you can make it a goal to talk to them, one of the parents every week. Just talk to one of the parents, like one of your student's parents every week. And make sure you communicate positive and negative as well. Don't just communicate when there's something bad. Okay, the last thing we don't want to skip is the moral failure. And this can be a difficult one to talk about. But what you do outside the classroom does affect your teaching. My father-in-law was a bishop who was failing in his personal purity, and there was no one else involved. No one knew that anything was wrong. But there were some issues in the church at the time that he was trying to deal with, and he was not able to deal with it. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. Moral failure is a stronghold that the devil will use to render you powerless as a teacher. The devil will wants you powerless, and he will use that. So find help. It's not something you can handle on your own. And just to finish the story, This was several years ago, but a year ago, my father-in-law had a blood clot, aneurysm in the brain, and he died. And his testimony was, before that, he said, it was embarrassing for him, but it's like, whatever it takes, I don't care. I want to be free. And he's free today. So don't just think that it doesn't matter. Get help. All right, I really wanted to cover the advantages of the first year teacher. I don't know. Let's see if we can go over them real quick here. So the first advantage is freshness. Everything is fresh and exciting. You're learning with them. And the students usually behave very well for new teachers. So that's great. They really want to please you. Just don't lose that throughout the year. The second thing is first-year teachers are usually very willing to learn. They're very willing to hear advice from other teachers. So don't never be ashamed to beg, borrow, or steal advice or ideas from other teachers. The next thing is a positive attitude. And I love what Jonathan Irvin, how he says about this. He said, some of us that have been in the business for a long time need a checkup from the neck up. There's some stinking thinking in there that affects our attitudes, and we get cynical about student issues. So you don't have that. You can have a positive attitude. And you can sympathize with your students as well. You just remember struggling through this a few years ago, or maybe it's been 10 years ago, but you can sympathize with them. But a teacher that taught 3 years says, I've taught this three years in a row. You should know this. And we don't realize that we struggled one time too. So in closing, you're all going to make mistakes. We all do. But don't get discouraged. The only dumb mistake you make is the one that you keep on making. So learn from your mistakes. Listen to advice from others. Stop, look, listen, and pray often. God bless you. You're dismissed.